From Storyflow, this is your daily audio brief for June 26th. Mason, June 26th. Quick read on what moved overnight. Five stories, no fluff. Let's get into it. First, from Options Oracle, trade idea for Thursday, June 25th, 2026. 73% probability of worthlessness and 78% probability of profit frame today's option play. The stock stays firmly bullish. A modest pullback lets the trader set a strike just under current price, hugging a long-standing support zone and the rising 50-day moving average. That placement leaves room for consolidation while still collecting a decent premium, and the break-even sits below the strike, adding a layer of downside cushion. As long as the company keeps delivering, the system-based approach will keep feeding setups like this without the need to chase higher prices. Next. Second, from Starfire Codes. You know what you want to do. That's not the part that's stuck. $199 for a one-hour session. That's the price Demi, a certified life coach, charges to help people who already know what they want but keep hitting a wall between intention and action. She's been coaching for years, and she says most clients aren't clueless. They've had the goal in mind for a while. The real challenge is figuring out what's silently holding them back, whether it's habit, fear, or just a missing step. In a typical hour, they map out the current spot, the desired destination, and the obstacles in between. It's a focused, no-fluff conversation that aims to bridge that gap. Spots fill up fast. Once they're gone, that's it. If you're ready to move past the stall, you can book through her calendar. Up next. Third, from Starfire Codes. Otto Warburg may have identified the cause of cancer in 1931. The research funding went to a different theory instead. Most people who receive a cancer diagnosis are told two things. First, that cancer is caused by genetic mutations. Second, that the appropriate response is to target those mutations with pharmaceutical intervention. Both of those things rest on a research paradigm that a Nobel Prize winner directly challenged in 1956 in a paper published in Science, and that a Boston College biology professor spent his career systematically confirming ever since. The finding has not disappeared. It is in the peer-reviewed literature. The research funding went somewhere else. Otto Warburg received the Nobel Prize in Physiology or Medicine in 1931 for his work on cellular respiration. He spent the following decades applying what he had learned about healthy cell metabolism to cancer cells and arrived at a conclusion he stated plainly in a 1956 paper in Science that cancer has one primary cause. That cause is the replacement of normal oxygen-based cellular respiration with a less efficient process called fermentation, in which cells metabolize glucose without oxygen. This is now known as the Warburg effect. It is observable, measurable, and reproducible. PET scans used in oncology today work by detecting this exact metabolic signature. Cancer cells consume dramatically more glucose than healthy cells because their mitochondrial machinery is damaged and they are running on fermentation instead. Warburg's position was specific, that genetic mutations are a consequence of the metabolic dysfunction rather than the cause of it. If a cell's ability to produce energy through normal respiration is damaged, the downstream result is the instability we call cancer. According to Warburg, the mutations are symptoms. The metabolic damage is the disease. The genetic mutation model won the research funding. The practical reason is not difficult to identify. A metabolic model points toward interventions that cannot be patented, such as dietary modification, fasting protocols, and metabolic therapies that address the cellular energy environment directly. The genetic mutation model requires identifying specific mutations and developing targeted pharmaceutical compounds to address them. That is a research and commercialization pathway with a clear revenue structure. The 5-year survival rates for most major solid tumors have improved modestly over the 50 years since the National Cancer Act of 1971 directed the primary research investment toward the genetic model. The metabolic model has not received comparable funding. Channeled messages posts go out to paid subscribers every day. tarot, shufflemancy, numerology, runes, and meditation applied to the specific energies of the day, delivered directly to your inbox. Thomas Seyfried is a professor of biology at Boston College who has spent his career documenting Warburg's mechanism with modern scientific tools. His 2012 book, Cancer as a Metabolic Disease, published by Wiley, and his 2014 review paper in Carcinogenesis, co-authored with researchers at the University of South Florida, present the accumulated laboratory and clinical evidence for Warburg's 1956 claim. Seyfried's central argument, supported by nuclear cytoplasmic transfer experiments, is that cancer arises from mitochondrial dysfunction rather than from nuclear genetic mutation. According to Seyfried, when the nucleus of a cancer cell is transferred into a healthy cell's cytoplasm, the resulting cell behaves normally despite carrying the tumor's genetic material. When a healthy nucleus is transferred into a cancer cell's cytoplasm, the resulting cell behaves as a tumor cell. The cytoplasm, which houses the mitochondria, determines the outcome. The nucleus does not. Seyfried's research has documented that specific metabolic interventions reduce tumor growth in laboratory and clinical settings. The ketogenic diet restricts glucose availability while providing an alternative fuel source, ketone bodies, that cancer cells running on fermentation cannot efficiently use. Caloric restriction reduces circulating glucose and insulin, removing the primary substrate cancer cell metabolism depends on. Hyperbaric oxygen therapy increases oxygen availability in the tumor environment, which exploits the metabolic vulnerability of cells that have shifted to anaerobic fermentation. None of these are pharmaceutical interventions. Each has published safety and efficacy data in peer-reviewed journals. Max Gerson arrived at the same functional conclusion empirically in the 1920s, 40 years before Warburg's 1956 paper, and more than 80 years before Seyfried's book. He developed a nutritional cancer therapy based on what he observed clinically, that cancer responds to dietary intervention that restores normal cellular oxidative function. He presented his findings before the United States Senate in 1946. A bill to fund research into his protocol failed by 2 votes. And then, fourth, from Starfire Codes. Sometimes you need to look at life from a different point of view. Channeled messages. Follow your joy and do not take your life for granted. Your life is precious and your attention matters. You are being provided with an opportunity to change, to move on to the right path. Read more. Next. Fifth, from Behavioral Value Investor. 10-Minute Investment Autopsy, number 21. Hein Celestial, Hein. 97% total return for Hein since August 2019, while the S&P 500 climbed about 183% in the same span. That gap tells you the story right away. Glenn Welling's 2019 autopsy painted Hein Celestial as a natural food pioneer that overextended with acquisitions, then stumbled on integration and innovation. A board shakeup and a new CEO from Pinnacle Foods were meant to reset the ship, and the first 3 quarters showed EBITDA margins nudging up from 6% to 10%. Management now targets 13 to 16% margins and 3 to 6% organic sales growth, with a hefty equity grant that only vests if the stock delivers a 15% annualized return over 3 years. The implied fair value price sits around $40 per share. In practice, the turnaround never materialized. The stock's collapse and the sector's tightening competition suggest the original thesis missed key execution risks. It's a reminder to watch integration plans closely and to temper optimism with realistic runway. Up next, sixth, from the lead lag report, gold refused the peace trade but couldn't refuse the dot plot. Track major stock catalysts and expected price moves using institutional-grade data, minus the manual grind. Stop wasting hours on manual research. Scouter synthesizes fundamental data, technical analysis, and historical price volatility into clear dashboards for upcoming events. See trend scores and expected moves across 10,000-plus tickers in one place. Gold breached its $4,320 COMEX floor for the first time, settling $4,129.90, 22.35% from the Jan 29 ATH of $5,318.40. But the catchdown lines up with Warsh's first dot plot, not the Hormuz tanker resumption. U.S. equities cracked on an AI chip route, S&P 500, 1.94% on the week to 7,065.46, the NASDAQ composite, 2.99%, XLK, 4.14% on the day, VIX 18.77% to 1949, and the curve bear steepening into a hawkish SEP. Korea's KOSPI triggered its fourth circuit breaker of 2026, 9.99%, as Samsung and SK Hynix shed 12% plus, exporting chip contagion to Tokyo, Hong Kong, and Wall Street, while the ECB and BOJ pressed ahead with rate hikes. Let me lead with a contradiction. For 6 weeks, the gold refusal decoupling thesis rested on a single stubborn fact. Gold would not follow crude down the Hormuz peace trade. Oil bled, yields obeyed, and bullion sat there at $4,353, refusing the script. This week, the $4,320 floor finally broke. COMEX front-month gold settled $4,129.90, down 1.24% on the session and roughly 5.1% across the week, and the lazy red is that the refusal was a mirage all along. It was not. Gold did not break because tankers started moving through the strait again. It broke the same week Kevin Warsh's first FOMC handed the market a dot plot with hikes penciled in. Gold refused the peace trade. It could not refuse the dot plot. That distinction is the whole addition. Start with the inversion that drove everything else. The Federal Open Market Committee, under its new chair, held the funds rate at 3.50%, 3.75% on June 17th. But the decision was never the event. The summary of economic projections was 9 of 18 participants now pencil in at least one 25 basis point hike for 2026, with the SEP lifting 2026 core PCE to 3.3% from 2.7% in March, an admission of inflation persistence that the prior edition called a stagflation tell. That repricing, not Hormuz, is what pulled real rate-sensitive gold off its floor and sent the dollar to a 13-month high. The dot plot is the gravity well. Everything in this report orbits it. U.S. equities cracked under that gravity. The S&P 500 fell 1.43% on Tuesday to close 7,365.46, down 1.94% on the week from the prior 7,511.35 baseline, while the NASDAQ composite shed 2.99% on the week and the NASDAQ 100 dropped 3.29% on the session alone. The epicenter was the AI chip complex. A violent KOSPI-driven semiconductor unwind, Samsung and SK Hynix, each down more than 12% in Seoul, cascaded into Wall Street, dragging the technology sector ETF XLK down 4.14% on the day as Micron sold off roughly 13% into its earnings. The Dow held within a fraction of flat, and the Russell 2000 finished the week higher, a textbook signal that this was a mega-cap valuation reset, not broad credit stress. High-yield credit barely flinched. The VIX jumped 18.77% to 19.49, elevated caution rather than fear, still shy of the 20 handle. Underneath the equity tape, the bond market told the same hawkish story in a different language. The curve bear steepened post-FOMC, the 10-year backed up toward roughly 4.51% as the dot plot shock did its work, before Tuesday's risk-off sent a flight-to-quality bid back into Treasuries. The macro print sharpened the contradiction the Fed is now living inside. The S&P Global Flash Composite PMI rose to 52.2, a five-month high, with manufacturing at a 49-month high, even as the survey flagged factory employment falling at its fastest pace since 2009 and input price inflation near its highest since early 2023. Growth and inflation are both running hot while hiring buckles. That is not a recession call. It is the simultaneous growth plus inflation persistence signal that tightens Warsh's exit path and validates the dot plot the market spent the week trying to fade. Asia delivered the week's defining shock, and it was structural. Korea's KOSPI plunged 9.99% to 8,203.84, triggering a level 1 circuit breaker, the fourth of 2026 and 10th in the index's history, after the Financial Supervisory Service warned that regulators had been too hasty approving 16 leveraged single-stock ETFs on Samsung and SK Hynix, products with roughly $9 billion in mostly retail assets. Foreign investors dumped some $2.6 billion in a single session. This is the same leveraged ETF fragility that produced June's earlier circuit breaker, and it is the channel that carried chip contagion to Tokyo, where the Nikkei 225 fell 3.55%, snapping an 8-day winning streak that had earlier broken 70,000 intraday for the first time. And then, 7th, from Friday forward. Friday forward, trillionaire debate. Dugra 542. 2 weeks ago, Elon Musk became the world's first trillionaire on paper after SpaceX issued its initial public offering, IPO. The response from many was predictable. The very next day, I saw a CNN panel where a politician held up Musk's net worth in contrast to the need for more resources and better public infrastructure for constituents in his district. Another panelist rebutted him by correctly pointing out that Musk's wealth did not come at the expense of the politician's district, and if SpaceX didn't exist, the district wouldn't suddenly be richer. There are legitimate criticisms of Musk, some of which I have made before, but in this specific area, many people are distorting the picture, reaching for arguments that stir outrage while ignoring basic economics. It's true that the SpaceX IPO created a massive amount of wealth for Musk. It also created life-changing wealth for many other people. The SpaceX IPO turned roughly 4,400 current and former employees into millionaires and pushed around 400 of them past $100 million. Most were not executives. Many were machinists, engineers, process planners, and rank-and-file workers. This includes a welder who joined SpaceX in 2015 because he needed the paycheck and whose shares are now worth just over $1 million. These are transformative outcomes for real people, but you won't find much discussion of their stories in the headlines. It's also worth noting the trillionaire headline everyone argues about is also misleading. Musk does not have $1 trillion in the bank. In fact, his net worth actually dipped below $1 trillion shortly before this article published. Instead, his net worth is the value of his equity in the various companies he built. And wealth creation isn't zero sum. Every dollar of value of SpaceX isn't taken out of someone's pocket. The companies Musk built are worth about $3.5 trillion today, roughly $1.5 trillion for Tesla, and more than $2 trillion for SpaceX. None of this value was created by accident or without significant personal risk. Musk poured nearly the entire $180 million from the PayPal sale into SpaceX and Tesla. At one point in 2008, both were nearly bankrupt and he had to borrow money to cover rent. Musk risked everything he had to bring these companies to the top of the market, and he's being rewarded for that risk. While his own share of those companies is worth about $1.1 trillion, the other $2.4 trillion belongs to others, including the index and pension funds inside millions of ordinary retirement accounts. More than 140,000 people draw a paycheck from his companies and spend that money into the economy. Reusable rockets seeded a commercial space industry, Starlink put internet access where fiber never reached, and Tesla pushed the global auto industry into electric. Elon Musk does not need me to defend him, but I have an allergy to arguments that are made loudly, intended to stoke populist outrage, and don't hold up to scrutiny. There are good arguments for criticizing Elon Musk. His controversial work with Doge is a reasonable target. It's worth debating whether one person should hold this much sway over rockets, satellites, AI, and a media platform, or whether he should enjoy a direct line into the government. There is also the fact that extreme wealth gaps have always frayed our social fabric and have often become a source of considerable social instability. But criticizing Musk for being a trillionaire and suggesting he is hoarding money that could be better used elsewhere is economically inaccurate. Even Musk's critics can say so. Those who act as if Musk could simply use his newfound paper wealth to fix all manner of societal problems are not based in reality. He cannot simply liquidate his Tesla and SpaceX stock and give hundreds of billions to charity. Selling that many shares at once would crater the stock price. Meanwhile, wealth created from the IPO will begin to flow into the economy. When employees and investors sell their shares, they'll pay capital gains taxes. This includes Musk, whose $11 billion tax bill in 2021 was the largest individual payment in the history of the United States Treasury. And newly wealthy employees will buy homes, hire tradespeople, and pay the property taxes that fund their town schools. Those are real benefits that affect the real economy, and like him or not, that money was created through his businesses. No one has to like Elon Musk to be honest about how his wealth actually works and what it has built. Building things has always improved more lives than populist rhetoric ever has. Quote of the week: "There is not a fixed amount of wealth in the world. You can make more wealth." Paul Graham, have a great weekend. Bob New from Premium Next. 8th from Inside Talks, the 60-second video that does more for your booking rate than any pitch you'll ever write. Every host who considers booking you is carrying one question they'll never say out loud. Will this podcast guest be good on mic? A written profile answers almost every other question a host has. Topic fit, credibility, past appearances, audience alignment. All of it visible, readable, accessible in under 2 minutes. But presence? Energy? Whether the conversation will actually be worth giving to their audience? A bio can describe those things. A video demonstrates them. Hosts who watch your video pitch make booking decisions faster, with more confidence, and with less back and forth than hosts who only read your profile. That's your claim about what happens when a host can answer their most important unspoken question before they've committed to anything. Most guests think of the video pitch as a nice-to-have, an extra layer of polish on an already complete profile. A video pitch is a trust accelerator. Three things happen when a host watches yours that can't happen any other way. They hear how you actually sound, not how you describe your voice or your style, but how you actually speak, pace yourself, and hold attention. A podcast host can evaluate in 30 seconds whether you're someone their audience will stay engaged with or not. They feel whether you're genuine. Written copy can be crafted and polished to project any quality, but a 60-second video is much harder to fake. Podcast hosts who watch your video know quickly whether the warmth and confidence in your talk's creator profile reflects how you actually show up. They make a decision faster. Uncertainty slows booking decisions, and a video pitch removes that specific uncertainty written profiles can't address. Hosts who feel confident about a guest's presence reach out sooner and with fewer questions. Most guests overthink the video pitch. The goal isn't to deliver a performance. The goal is to have a conversation with the host before the host has agreed to have one with you. Five elements make a 60-second video pitch work. Not your name, not your job title. The outcome you create for a specific person. What this looks like. If you host a show for coaches or consultants who want to grow their business through podcast guesting, I'd love to talk about being a guest. Why leading with outcome works. A host watching 5 video pitches in a row remembers the ones that immediately told them whether the guest was relevant, while the ones that open with name and credentials blur together. What to avoid. A formal introduction that sounds like the beginning of a keynote presentation. The energy of a video pitch should match the energy of a conversation, not a performance. One sentence that connects your expertise to the kind of listener the host is trying to serve. What specificity looks like. I specifically cover the pricing conversation that most coaches avoid having with themselves. And in my experience, that conversation is the one that changes everything about how fast their business grows. Why this one sentence matters. It gives the host an immediate picture of what an episode would look like and who it would help. Vague topic descriptions in a video pitch are more damaging than vague written descriptions because the host is watching you deliver them. The test. Can a host who watches your video pitch describe the episode you'd deliver in one sentence to someone else? If yes, the topic communication worked. A concrete takeaway, insight, or framework the listener will walk away with. What concrete looks like. By the end of the episode, your listeners will have a specific framework for pricing their services that accounts for where they are in their business right now, not where someone else's pricing guide assumes they should be. Why this converts. It moves the host from evaluating whether to book you to imagining the episode already produced. That mental shift is what makes a host reach out. What to avoid? Vague promises about inspiration, transformation, or value without specifying what form that value takes. One sentence that tells the host exactly what you'd like to happen next, what this looks like. If this sounds like a fit for your audience, I'd love to connect and explore what an episode could look like. Why low friction matters. A video pitch that ends with a hard sell creates resistance. A video pitch that ends with an open invitation creates momentum. What the ask is not, a request for a confirmed booking, a specific recording date, or anything that requires the host to make a decision before they've had a chance to think, not 65 or 90. 60 seconds only. Why the hard limit matters. A host who watches a 2-minute video pitch is a host who's already doing more work than they expected. The 60-second limit signals that you respect their time before you've even started the conversation. What to cut if you're running long? Anything that's already visible on your written profile. Up next, 9th from Because of Marketing, inside Cannes Lions. Pinterest turned Cannes Lions into a hands-on playground, dubbing it the Manifestival at the Carlton Beach Club. Attendees swapped screens for stickers that read, less URL, more IRL, then drifted through tattoo stations, a Sephora-styled hair bar, and a pastry counter that turned personal aesthetics into edible treats. The visual search studio, built with Adobe, printed custom journals from each guest's Pinterest searches, while designer Clara Chu led a style lab where fans crafted one-off accessories. An offline social club let people send handwritten postcards, tapping into Gen Z's love of analog connection. Rachel Higgins and Kate Edwards reported the buzz, noting the shift toward tangible, brand-driven experiences that bridge digital inspiration with real-world interaction. And then, 10th, from E-Commerce Innovators Journal. E-Commerce Innovators Digest. 26th of June, we've curated the most valuable insights, trends, and strategies you need to stay on top of your game in e-commerce. Whether you're looking to optimize conversions, explore new growth tactics, or leverage the latest AI tools, this digest has everything you need to fuel your business growth. Dive into this week's must-read content and take your e-commerce strategy to the next level. Let's start. Access exclusive, high-paying remote AI training roles with flexible hours. No prior AI experience required. E-commerce data and catalog specialist, $40. $50 hour e-commerce simulation expert, $40. $50 hour management consultant, $154. $210 hour project management specialist, $63. $119 hour. Some of the highest converting e-commerce visuals are often the simplest rather than the most creative. The article argues that shoppers make fast decisions, so visuals that clearly present a product, its context, and its use case tend to outperform highly stylized or abstract imagery. While creativity remains valuable, it should support understanding rather than distract from it. Effective visuals reduce friction, keep the product central, and make it easy for customers to grasp what is being offered, ultimately improving conversion rates. Three key takeaways. Clear, easy-to-understand product images usually outperform visually complex or highly artistic designs. Online shoppers decide quickly, so clarity and immediate comprehension are often more important than originality. Creativity works best when it enhances understanding. Successful visuals balance brand identity with simplicity and product focus. OnCommerce is a new platform designed to simplify multi-channel retail by allowing sellers to manage multiple marketplaces and international markets through a single account, instead of maintaining separate listings, inventory, pricing, and workflows for each channel, sellers can upload products once and have them automatically distributed across relevant marketplaces. The platform currently includes access to marketplaces such as OnBuy and plans to support the upcoming EasyShop and Comet launches, giving merchants access to 21 markets and a combined audience of more than 140 million shoppers. The goal is to reduce operational complexity while making cross-border expansion easier. Three key takeaways. Sellers manage products, inventory, pricing, orders, and fulfillment from one central platform, eliminating duplicate work across multiple marketplaces. OnCommerce automatically distributes products to suitable channels and regions while handling VAT calculations and consolidating sales reporting. The platform offers immediate access to OnBuy and future access to EasyShop and Comet, helping retailers expand internationally without managing separate marketplace accounts. The article argues that e-commerce businesses gain the most value from AI when it is used as a connected system rather than a collection of isolated tools. Drawing on a recent McKinsey report, it introduces the concept of an AI flywheel, where improvements in one area, such as personalization, customer insights, inventory management, or pricing, generate better data that strengthens other areas. Even small and mid-sized retailers can create their own flywheel by using AI to analyze customer feedback, improve product content, measure results, and continuously feed those learnings back into the business. Three key takeaways. AI creates the greatest impact when it connects decisions across growth, productivity, operational efficiency, and profitability, instead of automating single tasks. Small retailers can build a practical AI flywheel by analyzing customer questions, reviews, and returns, then using those insights to improve product pages, FAQs, merchandising, and customer experience. The competitive advantage comes less from having the most advanced AI model, and more from consistently measuring outcomes, learning from data, and applying those insights across the business. The article argues that the EU's proposed €3 duty on low-value imports is not the real challenge facing cross-border e-commerce. Instead, it exposes a deeper problem. Retailers' dependence on fragile international fulfillment models that break down when customs rules, carrier networks, or border processes change. Using the recent DHL Global Mail suspension as an example, the author contends that operational resilience, not the duty itself, will determine success in Europe. That's the read. Watch the tape. Ignore the noise. Back tomorrow.